morning, everyone. The Mary Griffith Show is underway. It's the second Friday of the month, and that means the Quincy firefighters have stopped by to talk about what's happening in the fire department. Today we get the big kahuna. Joe Henning is here, the chief of the fire department. Welcome, chief.
Welcome. Thank you, I guess. And I promise you I won't come back again for a while so they can hear somebody else.
Okay. It's rotating. I love it when you're here, though, because unless there was a five-alarm fire, you can probably stay for the time. A couple of months ago, the radios went off, and I had to go to commercial break. Fortunately, they were not called to respond, so we were able to continue. But the Keep the Wreaths Red program, how would you determine its success? Tell us about that.
It was a good year. We've been doing it right around 10 years now. We've only had 1 year where we've not had a fire at all. Most years we tend to average around 5 or 6, and this year we ended with only 2. So that's a good year in my opinion.
Yeah, it's not perfect, but two fires between Thanksgiving and basically the New Year's holiday.
Yep.
And were those two fires, talk about a little bit, what kind of fires were those and how could those have been prevented?
So one was, while it's not been absolutely proven, it was a fire in a vacant home, so more than likely it was set, would be the assumption.
And somebody might have just been trying to get warm.
Exactly, but the point being, it was a vacant home, no utilities.
Right. So it was definitely deliberately set.
Yeah.
It didn't just
happen
on its own.
Whether they meant to, any malintent or not, we don't know. But yeah, and then the second fire was just a bit of a malfunction with a wood-burning stove.
Okay.
We actually caught the exterior of the house on fire, and we had some issues with that, but not a major fire by any means.
So these were two fires. You never want any fires, but these were two fires where no loss of life, no real problem for the Quincy Fire Department to put them out. But, of course, we always highlight around the Christmas time frame, Thanksgiving to New Year's, that time frame, it's cold. There's a lot of candles burning. There's a lot of gifts around. There's a lot of space heaters and wood burners. And it's just kind of a dangerous time of year. And that doesn't stop here on January 8th. That continues on. You mentioned the wood-burning stove. It is so critical to maintain those. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people forget. They wait until it's the first cold night of the year, and then they're like, well, we really should have looked at the flu. We should have done this. But, we'll get it next year.
That's absolutely the key when you're talking with, wood-burning stoves, fireplaces, whatever. You want to make sure you get your flu cleaned out. Not that was the issue here, but you also want to check the condition of the flu pipes. Make sure everything is together like it's supposed to be. Sometimes things can get bumped and unseated. There's clean-outs and those things. You want to make sure everything's getting cleaned out. Just doing general maintenance, that's certainly the key. And to be honest with you, when it comes to all fire safety, general maintenance is always going to be the key, whether it's a dryer, whether it's a stove, whether it's a wood burner, whether it's a grill. You got to make sure you're taking care of your stuff and you're using it the way the manufacturer intended it for it to be used.
My favorite story, and I think we talked about this last month, somebody's husky dog jumped up on the stove and turned on.
That's actually happened more than once over the years.
Yeah.
So it does actually happen, yes.
And so, again, I don't know how you prevent that because the dog's gonna jump up. But, just be extra cautious. You don't have stuff on your stovetop that could catch fire. It is not a platform to put the mail on and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
So the wreath program went pretty well. Things are looking good. Let's talk a little bit about firefighter training.
Okay.
Really, on a daily basis, the old myth that the guys just sat around the firehouse and played cards all day, that doesn't really happen. I don't think it ever really happened, but it really doesn't happen now.
There was a time maybe back in the day, but way back, yes. Yeah.
Because now you're really all about prevention. It's not just about what are we going to do if there is a fire, but it's preventing a fire. But when it comes to fire suppression, you have a very, very tight time frame to really be effective. And so how do you train to do something in such a short period of time that is effective?
Well, the key is you train, and you train often. We're blessed here in our community to have what we have dubbed the Quincy Regional Training Facility, which is essentially our live fire ground training area. It was built with some Illinois First dollars way back when with the help of Senator Donahue, Representative Ten House, and we've been able to add to that over the years. But that facility, we have a live burn facility where we can literally set fires in multiple areas of the building and practice firefighting evolutions. We can do high-angle rescue. We can do collapse. We can do fuel fire spills. We can do automobile fires. We can simulate a lot of the different types of emergencies that we deal with in real time. And by having the ability to do that in a controlled environment so we can train the new people safely, but also give recurring training to veteran firefighters, assures that they're going to stay sharp and have the ability to respond at the level we expect and need them to respond to. Because on the fire ground, there's not a lot of time to just sit around and think and ponder. You got to be able to react and you got to move quickly. Not that we run into situations uninformed, but there's not a lot of time to process things. So a lot of stuff needs to be automatic. We always train, and we always tell people, train like you're doing it for real. Because if you say, well, we're going to simulate this, we're going to simulate that, something's going to fall through the cracks. So you want to make sure you're training the exact same way you're going to do it in real life.
You are lucky to have that real life, you know, simulation where there's actual flame and stuff. Is it also possible with today's technology to train by social media, not social media, but by video or by
We have smart boards in all the stations now.
Yeah.
So I will tell you, during the COVID environment, a lot of live training, because a lot of evolutions, we call them multi-company drills, which means we bring three or four fire trucks together to do large-scale evolutions, because the reality is, you can't fight and put out a house fire with one fire truck and three guys. It takes a lot more people than that. The average working house fire could take, you know, anywhere from 12 to 15 people to do all the jobs quickly and efficiently. So, but during COVID, we weren't always able to get together and do that. So we do a lot of tabletop simulations, and we do have classroom types of things. A lot of our EMS training is just reviewing protocols, making sure we remember drug doses, different things like that. So there's a lot of things we can do in a classroom setting. We used to bring everybody together to sit in one spot, because we needed to train, but at the same token, that brought all the fire trucks to one point in the city. We do that a lot less now. There's still need occasionally, but more often now, if we can have the guys stay in their station and interact live via a smart board, we have that ability to still do that training and keep guys in their district so they can respond even quicker.
I want to ask you a question about something that I don't know. I never even thought about till yet Wednesday or whatever, but have you ever simulated what would happen if somebody tried to take over City Hall or the Adams County Courthouse or some major facility where, you know, elected officials were performing their duties?
We have been involved in active shooter training with the local police department and sheriff's department both. So the fire department role in that is a lot less than you would, you know, expect from law enforcement.
Unless a bomb goes off, I guess.
Right. Our job is to... honestly, a lot of what we do is about going in and recovering victims, bringing them out, triaging them, helping the ambulance service. You know, if we get a report of a bomb threat, for example, a good example there, our job is to stage far away because the reality is there's really nothing that we're going to do unless it goes off. You know, generally it's law enforcement going in, identifying the situation. If there's a threat at all, they're calling in a bomb unit from Springfield area or one of the local military bases. They come in and we just simply wait and they take a look, because there's no reason other than evacuating people. There's no reason to put lives at risk. So a lot of that is a wait and see game. But to your point about an active situation, our job is basically to help with the EMS side of things. And that's
right,
what
the medical side. And if there is a fire, or a fire comes because of a bomb or because of, you know, arson being deliberately set, you can't be staged right next to it, or you could succumb to it. So,
And we also, we work very closely with our law enforcement partners. If there's any kind of a risk involved, we have to wait until they've cleared the scene and given us the okay that it's safe to go in. I mean, if we have an active shooter in a fire, we're not going to go in until we know the shooter's been secured. You know what I mean? Now, we will do things from life safety evacuation standpoint, but, and sometimes putting out the fire is the best way to create life safety issues. So that's one of the tactical things you look at as a firefighter. Do you go for rescue? Do you put out the fire first? What's going to get you the greatest bang for your buck as quickly as possible? So every situation is a little bit different.
What is the most common call that the Quincy Fire Department responds to?
Most common call. We do about 4,000 responses a year, and around 2,000 of them are medical calls. So about half.
When people think of fire department and fire suppression, the Quincy Fire Department, you should think of emergency medical response and fire suppression. And I know that I think all of us have been driving, and the first thing you see is the fire truck go by, and then maybe a minute later, the ambulance right behind it. That fire truck is probably not going to a fire. It's going to an emergency medical response with the ambulance, just because of where they're stationed and they don't have as many units.
Right.
You can get there first, usually. You can assess the scene and get on the scene, and then they do the transport to the hospital and do all the other stuff once they arrive.
Right. We call that an EMS dual response program. So medical calls are rated from alpha to echo, with alpha being the least severe, echo being, you know, obviously dead, I guess, for lack of a better term. So we go on everything that's a Charlie, Delta, or Echo. So if it comes in, the dispatchers at 911, excuse me, will ask questions, and once the certain criteria are met, that triggers a fire department response in addition to an ambulance. And to your point, we have five stations spread throughout the city. The ambulances are all stationed around 30th and Chestnut in that area, and it's just where they're at. You know what I mean? So
it used to be all down at the hospital.
Right, right.
I mean,
so they're all, they've always been in one spot.
Right.
But what happens is, with us being able to run fire apparatus, we're in all the neighborhoods, so it just makes sense that we tend to get there first. And I don't remember the exact figure from last month, but about 65 to 70% of the time we get there first, and then about another 15% of the time we arrive at the same time as the ambulance. So the fire department definitely is on the front end of that.
When you say first responder, you really are.
Yeah, and that's not a knock towards our friends in the EMS side of things. It's just the virtue of two agencies finding a way to work together to provide a good level of service, and that's what we try to do.
I know years ago I served on a committee in the city, and there was a talk about banning leaf burning, and you know, mm-hmm. and one of the reasons that the fire department was in favor of it, because they love the smell of burning leaves as much as anybody, you know, we all do, but they said, you would not believe how many calls we have to go out to put out, you know, leaf fires that get out of control. So is that, you know, what, you, okay, most of your calls are heavier calls are EMS calls. What other things?
Everything else?
Yeah. I mean, are there a lot of traffic accidents you respond to? What is actually a building on fire? I think that's probably one of the least things you do.
Structural fires, which is building on fire, we do about 70 a year out of 4,000 calls.
Yeah.
So,
of course, those are the big ones.
Those are the ones that require the most training and the most resources, but it's the least of what we do, and that's a very upfront statement there. I mean, it is about 70. I'll give you a good example. The weekend of the ice storm. You know, one day we had 80 responses for power lines. So we do a lot of storm power lines, those types of things. Vehicle accidents are another big thing that we do. A lot of gas leaks and carbon monoxide detector calls. And then automatic alarms. You know, you have a lot of companies that have alarm systems in there. And if the alarm goes off, we respond because we need to know what's going on there. And a lot of people don't even know this. You know, a company will have an alarm go off and they'll say, oh, it's a false alarm. And they'll call 911 and say, tell the fire department not to come. It's a false alarm. We still respond. We may not respond lights and siren, but we're going to go because you just never know if maybe somebody's trying to do something malicious, you know, and set a fire and then call and say, hey, it's a false alarm, don't come. And then that gives the fire a head start. So we're always going to investigate. Anytime we're called, we're going to follow through and investigate is what we're going to do.
I think sometimes, we've talked about this before, people are reluctant to call if they aren't quite sure if there's a fire. The problem is, if you smell smoke or you smell something burning, by the time you actually see a flame or investigate and find a flame, you've wasted valuable time.
With new construction in particular and the new materials, now a fire will double in size about every 30 seconds. It used to be every minute, now it's about every 30 seconds. So
why is that? We'd be going, that's backwards.
Well, because the materials that we, you know, back when you and I were young, you know, everything was made out of wood and wool and natural fibers. Everything.
Back when I was young, it was a cave, so okay, it was, well, everything was made out of rock.
But
when you were young,
But everything now is a foam or a rubber or something like that, and it's made up of basically, I like to refer to it as frozen fuel, okay? So when you ignite a foam, it's going to light quickly, and it's going to burn intense, hot and fast, and puke out nasty dark black smoke. You burn a piece of wood, you don't get that, and it burns a lot slower. So it's the materials that are in our homes now, the things that our carpets are treated with, you know, the fabrics and the curtains, everything. A lot of it's fire retardant, so you do have that, but a lot of the other stuff, especially furniture, is a big one. You know, that stuff, when it burns, it's all foam. It's not natural material and burns hot and fast.
You know, I have a bathrobe and several bathrobes, thank goodness, but I have this one bathrobe where I caught myself on fire making eggs one morning. Now I quickly, you know, was able to extinguish it, but that part of my bathrobe tie that was on fire, it didn't burn away. Mm-hmm. It's still there, but it's like there's
melted.
It's melted.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought my bathrobe was made out of like cotton or something, obviously that bathrobe has
everything's plastic. yeah, absolutely.
Before we let you go, Chief Henning, I know you have a time constraint. What are some other things that you want people to know about this time of year about fire safety?
Well, certainly smoke detectors are always going to be the front line of defense. So we want to encourage people to make sure their smoke detectors are working. And what that means is, you know, once a month, just go up, hit that test button, listen for the beep. If you press that button and it doesn't make a sound, change the battery. If you change the battery and it still doesn't make a sound, it's time to replace that smoke detector. A lot of people don't realize smoke detectors have a finite life. Generally speaking, it's somewhere between 7 and 10 years. On the back of your smoke detector, there'll be an expiration date. If that detector's past that date, it's time to get a new detector.
Okay. Chief Henning, we've got to let you go. Thank you so very much. We look forward to next month in February when another firefighter will come in and talk about fire safety.
I believe Firefighter Stakeoff is coming. So
okay, yep. Fantastic. We'll look forward to that. Thank you very much. Happy birthday to Elvis Presley and also to Josh Bowl, the son of my partner in crime here at the radio station. Yes, Josh was born on Elvis's birthday, and thank goodness they didn't name him Elvis. They thought about it, but they reconsidered. Joining me now via the phone lines is the president of WirePoints, Ted Dabrowski. WirePoints is an independent nonprofit company delivering original research and commentary about the Illinois economy and government. And I'll let him go into that a little bit more. Welcome to the Mary Griffith Show, Ted Dabrowski. Glad to have you here.
Hey. Good morning, Mary, and thanks for having me on your show.
You're concerned about the state of Illinois. We've lost a lot of population. We continue to lose population. Some people are very upset with the government and the way our state is run. And you're hoping to attract businesses here, to retain businesses here, and to keep people in Illinois and to put down roots here. I'm a native, lived here pretty much all of my life, and so I'm kind of in agreement. We need to do something. So take it away. What's the magic answer?
Well, Mary, like you, my parents were immigrants to Illinois, and they came from two different countries. And when they came here in the late 50s and 60s, Illinois was the destination state for the country, and in many parts of the world, people were coming from everywhere, right? From Europe, from the South, and this was the place to be. And sadly, 50, 60 years later, with the state that's shrinking the most in the country, we're losing more. We've lost more people since 2010 than any other state in the country. So we're going the wrong way now. And when people leave, that means there's less investment, less tax base, a smaller tax base, less entrepreneurs. And, when you're not growing, you're shrinking, right? And it's a scary thought to think of an Illinois that isn't vibrant, isn't robust, and isn't one of the fastest growing states in the country.
Yeah, we don't have that natural influx. I know when I was in college, several of my sorority sisters, they spoke perfect English, but their parents were still Polish primary speakers, and Chicago was Little Poland. And you're right, everybody came from everywhere in the world. Fiddler on the Roof. Oh, you're going to New York, America. I'm going to Chicago, America. We will be neighbors, The understanding that once you got here, everything was going to be great. Unfortunately, the immigrants' children are not staying here. They are moving away, and nobody's coming in to replace them. We've got some very specific numbers that you want to run by. Our area is Adams County, primarily here in Quincy. You've got numbers for Schuyler County, Illinois. If you've got anything for Brown, Hancock, and Pike, I'd be interested in listening to those because right now, this part of our country, this part of West Central Illinois and that is served by WTAD Radio, is losing population. We're kind of leaking like a sieve.
Well, the thing is, we have to compete against other states, other counties, and, we need to attract people, attract businesses. And, right now, too many people find Illinois, it's too expensive to live here. There's not enough good-paying jobs, and we know about the corruption. So many of our units of government are corrupt, and so people are fed up and they leave. And if you look at all the counties, we have 102 counties in Illinois, 93 of them have lost population since 2010. So if you look at a color of the map, it's really ugly, right? Everybody's leaving. And of course, your area is not immune to that. Schuyler is down 10% in population since 2010. Adams is down almost 3%. Hancock down 7%. Those are big numbers. And if you look at other states, they're growing tremendously. In places like Tennessee and South Carolina and Texas and Florida, they're showing 10%, 15% growth rates in many counties. So it's the exact opposite of what's happening here. And, that means, our goal at WirePoints is to bring to light all the failed policies that are scaring away people. Let's fight back to get those policies corrected, and then we'll start to attract people and businesses again. If we keep going the same way we're going, it's going to get really ugly here.
Okay, let's go over those numbers again. Schuyler County lost 10% of its population. Hancock County, 7%. How much did Adams County lose?
2.6%. So not as bad.
Well, but we're
but,
kind of
but
the,
bad.
We're kind of it is, but we're kind of the metro hub. I mean, you know, unfortunately, our little dinky town is the biggest town within 100 miles. So, you know, when people say that it's Quincy metro area, people joke and laugh, you know, if they live in, you know, Chicago. But we are a metro area.
No, it, you know, it matters.
Yeah, it does matter. So let's talk about policies that you would like to see changed. Because when you lose this kind of population in Hancock County and Schuyler County, et cetera, there's nobody to buy your house. It's hard to get out. You know, sometimes people have to get out and just abandon what is there. And that is very problematic. So let's talk about some reforms that you say are needed to turn this around. Let's go for about a 3-minute overview, then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and maybe flush that out. So what are some of the reforms that need to happen?
Well, you know, number one, we have this huge debt load hanging over everybody in Illinois, and that's pensions. Our pension debt is by far the biggest in the country. Nobody looks like us. Our crisis is huge because of pensions, and that means that we're going to have tax hikes forever if we don't change our pension plan. And so that's number one. And unfortunately, Governor Pritzker right now says fixing pensions is a fantasy, and so he's not touching those. And we argue that if you don't touch pensions, people are just going to keep leaving because there's nothing to stop the tax hikes. So that's number one. Number two is we got to get property taxes down. You know, people's nest eggs are being destroyed. If you look similar to the population loss, it hits home values. We've looked at home values across the country at wild points, and, you know, prices are going up everywhere. But in Illinois, home values are not keeping up with inflation. And so that means people's nest eggs, their nest eggs are being destroyed. And the higher the property taxes are, the less money people put into their homes and the less they want to buy homes. And so that's a huge risk for us. So we need property tax reform. And I'd say the third thing that needs to happen is right now the collective bargaining laws favor the unions over ordinary residents in Illinois. The unions have all the power to negotiate higher and higher salaries. And if you look at you know, pension cost growth, salary growth for the government sector, it continues to go up, but the people that have to pay for that, which are the ordinary residents, their salaries are stagnant or going down. And so it's become very onerous to live in Illinois. Those are the big three that I think we have to do.
Well, you couldn't have called it a better time. It's interesting. I just had the fire chief on, and we didn't talk about that. We talked about fire suppression and fire safety, but you are very right. Firefighter and police officer pension is killing the city of Quincy, and we owe it to these guys. We promised it to them, but other pensions are killing the state of Illinois and property taxes. A government needs X to run, and so when your property tax starts to go down because the value of your home goes down, your property taxes don't go down. They always go up. You know, they always find a way to make sure that they bring in X plus whatever percentage they need to run the government. And I know that right now, City of Quincy, for example, is in some very tough negotiations with its union membership, with its aldermen about budget. You know, how are we going to fund a police department, a fire department, and have a road project, and do this, and do that? So it's going to be tougher. Let's just put it that way. We're going to take a break at that. And Ted Dubrowski, you brought up the three main areas where I think we'll spend the rest of our morning talking. But if you'll hang on the line, sir, we're going to
we'll
head
do.
Up. We're having a political discussion today. I don't know who we want to attribute the devil in disguise to, but I'm sure we all have somebody we can put in that position. Ted Dubrowski joins me from Wire Points. He's the president. They're an independent nonprofit company. And they want to help improve the Illinois economy and government and basically keep people living here. What you've outlined, though, Ted, if I may be obvious, is it sounds like a very Republican-leaning solution to some of these problems. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, I don't know if it's a fair assessment. The Republicans haven't really been proposing a lot of these things either. I think what we're proposing is just to find a way to make things affordable for any Illinoisan. And if you look at this, I'm sure both Republicans and Democrats are leading the state.
So you're mad at both of them.
Well, yeah, because in the end, you know, all you have to do is look at the population loss. No other state looks like us. And, you know, voters are voting with their feet. I don't think they're just a Democrat or Republican. You know, you had a lot of blacks leave from 2000 to 2010 from the Chicago area. So it's everybody leaving because you can't find your future here. And if you can't find your future, you go elsewhere.
Okay, so let's talk about this. You outlined three things, and the first and, frankly, most boring and least easy to explain and glazed over, and this is why lawmakers have continued to be able to punt it, kick the can, is because nobody really understands this. So we have obligations to people. We have obligations to teachers. We have obligations to all kinds of state employees and local employees that we have said, if you serve us, we will give you a pension. We have never put enough money in many cases, not all, to cover that pension. Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, it's okay, but many of the other ones are underfunded. So now we're at the bottom of a 12-foot well, and water's pouring in, and we're trying to, grab a rope and only go up 1 inch a year. It's not going to help. So what is going to happen with pensions? How can we solve this problem?
Well, you know, we put out a plan at WirePoints, and we have a page dedicated to it called Pension Solutions. And we try to lay out three basic steps that we have to take. One is we just have to move away from pensions going forward. They're really expensive. You know, our goal is not to try to take away anybody's pension. We just want to reform them going forward. And so we think everybody should get a 401k plan, just like everybody in the private sector has. And, you know, the state has had a plan just like that for 20 years that university workers get. They're in 401k style plans. We think everybody in the government should have that. And that would simplify everybody's lives. It would also make state workers not dependent on the politicians to run their retirements. So that's number one, and it's a plan we already have. All we need to do is copy and paste it to all state workers. That's number one. The big change for pensions is these cost of living adjustments, these automatic raises, 3% compounded, that retirees get. We need to means test those and make sure that those with small pensions get these COLAs, but for a long time we need to suspend those COLAs, and that's the way to make sure that everybody's pensions get paid over the next 30 years. And then step number three is we just have to stop giving away free retiree health insurance for state workers. Today we give that away for free. It's a really expensive benefit. Nobody in the private sector gets that, and we're just saying that the public sector should pay for half of their costs, which is the national average. So these are three things. You're right, they're wonky, people's eyes glaze over, but if we don't do that, we're going to keep having a mess.
Those are common sense. I mean, here's the situation. I know there'll be problems because, I mean, you know, if I'm sitting here at the radio station and I've got all my benefits and all my package and everything, and the company says the new hires won't have it. Well, those new hires know that, especially since none of us can keep our mouth shut in media, you know. So they're going to be sitting there going, well, gee whiz, you know, Griffith's sitting over here with all XXX, and I'm sitting over here with nothing. But the truth of the matter is it will probably be harder to hire teachers, firefighters, police officers, government workers, transportation, truck drivers. It'll be harder because you won't have the benefits package, but it solves a problem. That's a short-term problem. It solves a long-term problem. There's not a lot of political will, though, on either side of the aisle to get people that are working people mad at you. So, okay, good ideas,
implement. Now, we know it's hard to implement, and it's not going to be implemented right now by the current leaders. They don't like this idea. They shun it. However, you know, you have to add the fact that we're almost a junk rated. No state has ever been rated junk by the rating agencies. We're almost rated junk. We're losing more people. And, you know, if you look at our bills, we can't pay them. So something's going to have to give. And at some point, politicians will have to either, you know, get a federal bailout. But if they can't get a federal bailout, they're going to have to start doing common sense reforms because they're going to run out of options. They can't keep borrowing and they can't keep taxing.
Property tax relief next on your agenda. Here is the big problem, like, for example, in every school district, but I'm more familiar with Quincy finances. The state of Illinois is supposed to give, by Constitution, 51%. Most of its money is supposed to go to education. So to me, and to a lot of people who read that, that says that 51% of every dollar that's brought in ought to go to education. Well, forget that. They're basically giving, you know, 23 cents on the dollar. So the Quincy Public School District has no choice but to have a property tax to fund our local schools. When you say property tax reform, if we lower property taxes that are basically a local thing, if we don't get help, I mean, that's not going to help us at all.
Well, so here's the struggle, right? The more that the state spends for pensions, the less the state has for giving money to schools.
Yeah.
right? And so that's a big problem. Now, don't forget, the school pays for the teacher pensions.
Yeah.
And if you look at school spending across the state, until the last 2 years, the state was spending half of its education spending on pensions and the other half in the classrooms. So that's why I keep talking about pensions. Pensions are sucking up half of the money that the state puts towards education. So you got to fix that. And then if you do the pension reform, then you'll have money left over for the right things. But, Mary, I live in a school district where we pay $6, $7, and $8 million lifetime pensions to superintendents of overlapping districts. It's crazy the amount of money that goes to these bigwigs for these multi-million-dollar pensions. And all that money is going to the wrong place. It should be in the classroom with our kids.
Well, we've got the same problem, too. I mean, the number of people who are retirees of the Quincy, Illinois public school system who, you know, are going to amass over $1 million very quickly is a pretty long list. So, okay, we've outlined the problem. Really, the problem's already been outlined. Now, how do you at WirePoints and how do you get common sense folks to agitate on your behalf? And I use that word. That was a bad word this week to use, agitate. I don't mean go storm the Capitol in Springfield. I mean put the feet to the fire of the people we've already elected and make sure that the next time we go to the voting booth, somebody that has pension reform as their number one priority is who we pull the lever for.
Well, you know, I want to be somewhat optimistic, and I've been pretty pessimistic over the last decade.
Yes, please do, because I'm about ready to jump off, you know, the top of the building. Thank you.
Well, think about it. Governor Pritzker and others, you know, had this plan to pass a tax hike, a progressive tax hike, and they structured a tax hike that had 97% of the population could vote against the 3% richest population. So this is, in theory, the easiest tax hike to ever pass. Like, they actually let the people say, you know, Pritzker and others said, hey, you people decide. 97% of you can put a tax on the 3% to fund stuff. And the 97% or Illinois rejected that plan.
Because they don't trust that. If they really thought that was going to happen, they would have voted yes. But nobody trusts anybody anymore at their word.
Well, it's the first time we've seen them reject some of these things coming from Springfield. So that's why I say somewhat optimistic. I don't want to be overly optimistic. So at least the people are starting to figure that out. Now you start to add the increasing out migration. I think this losing 80,000 people in 2020 is just the next embarrassment. You know, they're trying to blame Rauner, they're trying to blame weather, they're trying to blame inequity, they're trying to blame all kinds of things. But this is just a trend that has been going on for years. And the last thing is that you've got the national community, the bankers, the rating agencies saying, you can't play those silly games you've been playing with your budget anymore. They're all watching us, and they're going to rate us junk. So all those things are pressure points on the politicians. Now what we need are the people just, you know, hammering their local politicians saying, we want reforms. We want pension reform. We want lower property taxes. We don't want tax hikes, and we don't want any more debt and any more gimmicks. And I think, you know, the more people can have speaking up, the better.
Well, let me ask you this simple question, because as you may or may not be aware, one of Mike Madigan's closest friends is a gentleman from Quincy, Mike McLean. He's been a lobbyist for years, and he has been indicted. Madigan has not. If Mike Madigan, even though, again, he has no charges against him, it is under suspicion, if Mike Madigan is reelected the Speaker of the Illinois House, have we said, in a way, we don't care?
Well, this is a tricky thing, too, right, because you know, we the people don't vote for Madigan. We vote for our representatives, and our representatives then go and vote for Madigan or not.
Right, I understand that. But if they don't feel any, there'll be any, you know, if that happens, have they basically said, we don't think you folks are going to do anything about it?
Well, I think we're still there. I don't think we're at that moment yet. I think we haven't felt the pain yet. People are feeling the pain, and they're leaving. But if in fact things get a bit worse, and by that I mean that the bond markets don't want to give Illinois money, then it's going to get a little bit more chaotic and frenetic, and that's going to force people to look at things a little bit differently. And maybe that's the point, but we're not there yet. I don't think we're not at that pressure point yet. Madigan, you know, amazingly still has that power, even though he seems like he's short votes now, but, you know, that legislature has not been changed yet. We're not angry enough yet at our legislature. We haven't changed them and made them reformers yet. They're still, my guess is still status quo legislators.
Okay. So it's very interesting. Ted, I've enjoyed this conversation. you're right. I mean, you can just, you can look at it and get very depressed, or you can say, well, you know, let's see what we can do, and hopefully people will, you know, very carefully quit looking at D's and R's and start looking at people who have some will to solve this
some
problem.
Some principle.
Yeah, some principle and some will. You think we can find that in Springfield, Illinois, Jefferson City, Missouri, or Washington, D.C., honestly?
You know, I believe in Illinois. I don't believe in this corrupt group of legislators right now, but I do believe that over time and eventually, and we may have to go through some serious pain, and I've seen this in my professional world. It may be that we have to go through some serious pain in Illinois, but I do believe that we have great assets, great people, great history. This is a place that at some point will be turned around. I just hope that we can turn around before it collapses.
Okay, thank you so very much. We're out of time. You've been great. We'll talk to you again hopefully soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary.